And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Been craving some fresh fish lately? You're not the only one, and that's the problem. The demand for fish worldwide and our newfound taste for the fresh catch is having a huge impact on the world's oceans. Is cod okay, or snapper, or maybe shrimp? It's all so confusing. But there's a handy new little pocket guide that will help you find your way to healthy choices for the oceans and you. And you'll find out about all this and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Get ready. March is right around the corner. And if the current winds of change are any indication, March will come in like a pride of lions on a hunt. Politics is everywhere, dominating the news. From Port Dubai, the emerging civil war in Iraq, the mullahs of Iran, domestic spying. The only way nature can penetrate into the headlines is when it is devastating, as it was in the Philippines, as a whole village was buried in a massive mudslide. We all heard about that. There was a time when nature was associated with peace and beauty, solace, and the grand American ideals of freedom and individualism. And the sad truth is that nature now is wounded. I wish it wasn't so. As a boy, I was filled with wonder. I never dreamed that this day would come. And I'm not alone. Most everyone I know feels this same sense of loss. We on planet Earth are in tough times. I often question whether I'm being too negative, and I question because I'm a very positive person. But a time has come, an historic time, a turning point, when we need to speak the truth, and that's what we do here on the Wild Side News each week. In many respects, our best hope right now is to change. If everyone on this planet just put consumption on hold for a couple of years, slowed our stampede to every corner of the earth to yank from its hills and mountains, lakes and sacred places, every valuable commodity to bring to the marketplace, well, the only one hurt would be the greedy. But we could do with a lot less greed these days. But it's not going to happen. So it's up to each of us to do our part, to act responsibly and intelligently and cooperatively to reinforce wisdom. Our greatest wisdom right now comes in uniting our common wisdom into a change agent. And it's happening. Today we head north a bit, up the coast to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, the legendary showcase of oceanic creatures. Over the years, the Monterey Bay Aquarium has become fully aware of the changes in the realms of the oceans, and they're expanding their educational mission across the nation to help build awareness that we have the power to change the future of life on Earth, and the power to choose right is our most important freedom, which we can still exercise with wisdom. It's a show about fish and fishing and the food it brings, and how you can turn the tide of the ocean's future. And it may seem a stretch to tie in the debate over domestic spying into a show about nature and the environment, except that from the great American legacy of our national parks grew a firmament to freedom enshrined in our national parks and monuments. They serve as beacons which shine the light of our past onto the uncertainty of our future. And Manzanar is a place that, thank God, lives on to do just that. It's your Voice of the Earth, from the common voices of the people who love the earth, coming up following the news. So now, the news. As leading fundamentalist churches unite to fight global warming, that is, to stop global warming, some animal scientists who study the fundamentals of gorilla behavior are inching ahead and acknowledging that these great apes are actually somewhat intelligent. According to Ingrid Porton, curator of primates at the St. Louis Zoo, these animals are smart enough to observe behaviors and imitate them. Researchers in other primate centers are quietly screaming that bonobos and other primates exhibit extraordinary awareness and can communicate with thoughts, reason, and have complex feelings and awareness. Meanwhile, the forests that make up the gorilla and bonobo homelands are being turned into pulp and timber so that people around the world can read about such findings in the newspaper, which are then thrown away the next day. While on the topic, President George Bush is quickly becoming the alternative energy president as he visited three states to promote using alternative energy sources. Although he did not repeat a promise to cut back on Middle East oil imports that drew complaints from leaders of the OPEC countries and was disavowed by his energy secretary. All the slipping and sliding about oil and its future in America was overshadowed when the president scheduled an appearance at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado, only to discover a few days before the visit that 34 of NREL's employees had been laid off due to cuts in funding. Well, the administration demonstrated its dedication to bringing a positive message to renewable energy by quickly transferring $5 million to the NREL facility, which allowed them to hire back the 34 employees days before the president's appearance to help the president's appearance as a strong advocate and champion of these new renewable energy demonstrations. The president summed up America's challenge to create an alternative to a reliance on Middle East oil imports when he stated, "Some of the nations we rely on for oil have unstable governments or fundamental differences with the United States. These countries know we need their oil, and that reduces influence. It creates a national security issue when we're held hostage for energy by foreign nationals that may not like us." Mr. Bush recently admitted an addiction to oil. The first step to a cure is admitting to being an addict. We're with you, Mr. President. Our addiction to oil is bringing out, as addictions of any sort so often do, unsocial behaviors and unreasoned reactions. This week, the Senate held hearings on the bill introduced by Pete Domenici of New Mexico, which would open up nearly 4 million acres to offshore oil and gas development and allow state governors to petition the Interior Department for waivers of current coastal leasing bans for natural gas development, allow oil production if the state agrees to it, and coerce coastal states to accept more offshore drilling and drilling closer to shore. Addiction. Fight the disease. Just say no. Paul Watson, who was featured in a live satellite hookup here on the Wild Side News while he was chasing a Japanese whaling ship from the frigid waters of the Southern Oceans in his ship the Farley Moat, is currently stuck in South Africa with his crew as the Farley Moat sits chained under police guard in Cape Town Harbor. The ship is being detained by South African marine officials who say it does not meet safety requirements. Labeled a pirate and an ecological terrorist by critics, Captain Watson says he is upholding international laws which are set up to protect whales from illegal hunting. "Nobody would walk by a kitten or a dog being kicked to death. Nobody would walk by a child being abused or a woman being raped and beaten," he says. "I don't see how anybody can stand there and watch when a whale is harpooned and dies an agonizing death without intervention." In California, doctors refuse to participate in an execution of a convicted rapist and murderer of a 17-year-old girl, claiming that improper administration of the three-drug sequence, if not administered properly, could cause pain and suffering. All the while in Greenland, glaciers are dumping more than twice as much water into the Atlantic Ocean now as 10 years ago. Over the last 20 years, the air temperature in southern Greenland has risen by 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Some researchers are predicting that the original estimate of a rise in ocean waters of 1 foot in the next 100 years could actually be 3 feet in 100 years. That's 1 foot in the next 33 years, which is a half foot in 16.5 years, and that's 6 inches in 8.25 years, 3 inches in just over 4 years, and over an inch in the next year. And here comes March, just around the corner. Get ready for another wild ride as things keep warming up on good old planet Earth. And that's the news. And now a few reminders. Next week, we go in-depth as we focus in on global warming with some of the leading experts in the field who will be participating in the Wallace Stegner Symposium on Global Warming. If you want to hear from the world's best voices of the Earth and be informed and make choices that matter for the future of life on Earth, tune in each week to your Voice of the Earth, the Wild Side News. And speaking of making wise choices... Well, here in the end of February 2006, the oceans just keep on moving to the forefront in the news all the time. Already people are beginning to talk about getting ready for the upcoming hurricane season. We're hearing stories of the Greenland ice sheet melting much faster than anyone had anticipated. And, of course, there's always the ongoing saga of what is absolutely happening to the oceans. And it's a bit tragic. So a lot of people are really beginning to step up to the plate and try to take control of our future and hopefully do something to reverse the trend, which is leading to the demise of so many creatures in the wild places, and that includes the oceans. And joining us now from the Monterey Bay Aquarium is Ken Peterson. Ken, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
First of all, let's talk about the Monterey Bay Aquarium. It's a legendary place. Give us a sense of what you guys are up to these days.
Well, the aquarium started out in 1984 with the idea of being a window into the marine life of California's Central Coast. We had a great location on Cannery Row, a historic cannery building that was completely rebuilt into a beautiful contemporary aquarium. And our original exhibits focused on our local and regional marine life. We were able, because the bay is a relatively pristine body of water, to pump 2,000 gallons a minute, water directly from the bay into the exhibits and send it right back into the bay. And so it really becomes a living extension of what's out in the bay itself. And we've grown from there in the two-plus decades since then to incorporate exhibits of open sea life a little farther off the coast of California, to develop a special exhibition program that brings in notable marine life from around the world so we can tell interesting and engaging stories to visitors, and also bring some conservation stories to people that might not be as obvious in the marine life of California waters. Also, over time, and as you mentioned at the top of the program, we have become more aware of the threats facing marine life. They have grown in scope, and the pace of the change affecting the oceans is increasing over time. And we realized that we could not just inspire people and wow them with beautiful exhibits that they'd never seen before, but we really had a responsibility to use the information that we had, share that with our public, and we hope motivate them to become stewards of the ocean in a variety of different ways.
This is open to the public. It's 7 days a week.
So the only day we're closed is Christmas Day, and it's 10 to 6 every other day. Summers and holidays, you get an extra half hour in the morning at 9:30. We're opening up.
And then as well, give us your website.
MontereyBayAquarium.org. And, in fact, people who log on to the website can look at 7 streaming webcams, one that points right out onto the surface of Monterey Bay, so you always know what the weather's like and whether the harbor seals and cormorants are on the rocks off our oceanfront decks. We have exhibits in our sea otters, cameras in our sea otters and kelp forest exhibits in our million-gallon Outer Bay exhibits, so you can check out the bluefin and yellowfin tuna, and if we ever get another young white shark, you'd be able to watch the shark there. So a lot of ways of kind of experiencing what's here, planning a trip, and a lot of educational activities for kids, for families, school groups, teachers, and scientists as well, and a growing section of conservation information, including ways that people can get active in becoming advocates for and stewards of the oceans.
How long have you been with the aquarium?
I actually started volunteering here as a volunteer guide back when the aquarium opened in 1984.
Wow.
And then went through a little career change a few years later and have been on staff since 1989.
I'm glad I asked, because people have always been fascinated by the oceans. There's every reason to. But what's the trend line here? What's happening with your visiting public and how their experience is perhaps changing?
Well, I think more people are looking at the oceans and have a bit of the ocean on the radar. For the longest time, it's out of sight, out of mind, the sense that the oceans are so vast and so alien, really, that first they're so big we can't affect them, and so alien because we don't really visit them the way we do places on land, that there was no sense of what is happening, what is going on to the health of ocean wildlife and ecosystems. As our awareness of the world at large has grown, as scientists have been able to do more investigating and looking at and bringing their images back, we have a much better sense of what's happening with the oceans, and a lot of it is not good. You're absolutely right. There are scientific studies in the last few years that indicate that 90% of the large ocean predators, the big tunas, the swordfish, the marlins, the large sharks, are gone. And they didn't just vanish. They were fished out because our fisheries management policies are not keeping pace with the technologies we have for extracting wildlife from the oceans. It's been called the last buffalo hunt by Carl Safina of the Blue Ocean Institute, and that's exactly what it is in many ways. Our hope is that as you raise people's awareness of these issues, not in a defeatist way, but in a way that gives them some sense of hope and empowers them to make a difference, that we can collectively protect ocean wildlife, ocean ecosystems, and restore the ones that have been so badly damaged by mismanagement over the years.
It's that effort of the Monterey Bay Aquarium that is bringing me to talk with you right now. I was going through my current edition of Mother Jones News, which brings the information that we oftentimes don't find and brings it in depth in ways that we oftentimes don't see as well. And included in the back of this was a little tear-out piece, a little fold-up pamphlet that fits handily into your wallet or purse or whatever, or pocket. And it's beautifully done. It's called the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch National Seafood Guide. What is this about?
We have been working since 1997, really, to change the way public views seafood and to use the power that we all have as consumers to transform the market for seafood in ways that supports sustainable wild fisheries and responsible, sustainable fish farming or aquaculture. The Seafood Watch program is the result of that effort, and it's grown and strengthened over the years. We have, over the course of the last 7 years, distributed, now it's close to 8 million of those pocket guides.
Fabulous.
Not just a national guide, which is generically good for the whole country, but regional guides that we've developed for every major region of the U.S., the West Coast, the Northeast, the Southeast, and Gulf Coast, the Midwest region of the country, Hawaii. We have guides in Spanish, both a national guide and a West Coast regional guide. We use a team of biologists and fisheries researchers to study the best and most current fisheries management data from national and international sources. We consult with commercial fishermen on what's going out in the water. We build sets of scientific reports that look at the health of all the species that are included on those lists, whether it is the accidental catch and kill of other species that when you're trying to get the particular one you want to bring to market, whether it's the impact that fishing gear has on the habitats that these animals depend upon and that other animals depend upon for their survival, with aquaculture, whether or not it's being done in a sustainable way or whether it's being done in ways that are exacerbating problems for other ocean wildlife. And we sort all of those recommendations by a set of criteria that we think contributed to healthy oceans over the long term and healthy ocean fisheries. And we rank all of the seafood as either a green list best choice, a yellow list good alternative, kind of the caution light. There may be some issues and problems there. And a red list of avoid species. And if you look at the pocket guide that you have in front of you, you'll see that the red list is fairly short. The best choices and the good alternatives list are fairly long. And I think a big part of the Seafood Watch message is there's a lot of good seafood out there. There are a lot of good choices you can make and substitutions you can make. And your power as a consumer can have a big impact on how the business of producing fish for human consumption is run.
Now, there's a number of criteria that you've used to make these selections, and briefly, and this is covered wonderfully, elegantly in the guide, these are the concerns that you look at. One is, where is the seafood from? Two, is it farmed or wild caught? And then three, how was it caught? And so these factor into the selections, and then, of course, there's other issues as well,
right,
such as whether or not there's many of these fish left or if they're abundant.
Exactly.
I grew up in the Midwest, and so fish to me meant, crappies, sunnies, trout, and walleye.
Okay.
So I've never been much in of a fish eater, but there's many people are in San Diego, and of course fish restaurants are everywhere. So I haven't become I haven't been forced to kind of confront looking at a package of fish and trying to decide whether or not this is something that I should eat. Let's start out by helping people understand when you go to buy fish, and then we'll also talk about the restaurants, but let's just say that you go into your local food market or fish store. How can you use this guide, for example, to help you in making wise choices to keep a sustainable world population of fish?
We've tried to make it as easy for people as we can and let people kind of make use their own criteria as to how much comfort or discomfort they have with the different seafood items. So, for example, if you are going to be very principled about seafood and you don't want to have any shades of gray in terms of, am I doing something that's going to be harmful for the environment in any way, shape, or form, you'd stick with the green best choices list. And it's pretty easy to tell. The seafood counters are responding not just to the work that we're doing through Seafood Watch, but through other institutions and organizations that are part of the broader seafood choices movement. They're now telling you, is this a farmed catfish? Most likely it is if it's in the market in the U.S. Are these shrimp trap caught? Are they U.S. wild caught shrimp? Are they farmed shrimp from somewhere else in the world? Actually, part of the whole homeland security infrastructure that's grown up in the last few years, there's now country of origin labeling on all seafood that you see in the market. So they actually have to declare, was this caught in, the United States, or does this come from Ecuador or from Thailand or from Vietnam or where it may be. So those are things that will help. The other way you can use it, and you're probably less likely to have some of that declarative information if you go to a restaurant, is simply use the pocket guide as a way of asking questions of the server when they come to your table. Mm-hmm. So if you say, is this salmon wild-caught or farmed, and they can't answer that for you, then knowing that farmed salmon is on the avoid list, the red list, and the wild-caught is on the green, if they can't answer it for you, you just say, all right, I'm going to make another choice tonight. And you've put that server and that restaurant on notice that they need to be more aware of what their consumers want if they want to keep you as a customer or keep selling that particular item that's on their menu.
This is interesting because when we look at the guide here, for example, salmon is listed in both the best choices and the avoid. And it's
and
kind of
good alternatives,
and kind of counterintuitive, in some respects. In other words, we'll get into some of the details here without getting too deep. But for example, I think it's informative to know the thinking behind this. For example, the wild caught from Alaska is considered a best choice, and then of course the farmed salmon, including Atlantic salmon, is considered a fish to avoid. One would think it would be the other way around. What's the story here?
One of the main criteria that we look at with wild-caught fish is there a good management system in place? In other words, are there quotas and timing and regulation of the fishing gear such that you're not taking too many fish, you're not taking them in a way that is destructive of other animals or of the habitat and ecosystems that sea creatures depend upon? And Alaska's wild-caught salmon is a best choice because it is among the most tightly regulated fisheries. It's done with hook and line, so you're not catching a lot of other animals, the bycatch that you don't want. It's not done with trawl gear or nets that are damaging or plowing the seafloor. So it's very clean fishery, and manage in such a way that the people who make a living catching fish are going to be able to do that for a long, long time. If you look at farmed salmon, the challenge there is that, by and large, they're densely concentrated, almost feedlot situations in relatively calm coastal water areas. So you have the problems associated with any dense concentration of wildlife or people in a small area. The wastes that they excrete are not necessarily flushed out by the waters very quickly, so you've got a local pollution problem. Because you're having the animals live more densely than they would in the wild, you have to use antibiotics or other drugs to control pests and disease, and that can then spread into the surrounding waters and ecosystem. The farmed salmon are often infested to one degree or another with sea lice, or that becomes a risk. And wild salmon in those same waters, in some cases where you're farming, can become infected with those lice as they swim past these farms. You also have issues of the possibility of those farmed salmon, genetic Atlantic salmon, escaping into the wild through, you know, storm or other damage to the net pans that are holding them, and suddenly they're out in the wild competing with wild stock, some of which are in trouble because of our mismanagement of forests and the construction of dams on their spawning rivers. So now they have another source of competition, and even the possibility that those genetic Atlantic salmon might start to interbreed with their wild Pacific stocks. So there are a variety of issues there. We're always hoping that someone will, within the salmon farming industry, will begin to develop standards and come up with a set of protocols for an acceptable and a clean salmon farming operation. But for the time being, there's no easy way for the consumer going into Costco or whatever supermarket that they shop at to say that, oh yeah, this farmed salmon was good versus that from another label that's not good. So we just say avoid it, stick with wild-caught salmon, enjoy it as a seasonal delicacy. It's phenomenal when it's fresh, and let it go the rest of the time and make another choice.
There's a lot that goes into making wise choices. When you return, you get up to date on making the right choices for yourself, for the oceans, and our world, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.